Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and associate professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I'm excited to be interviewing Paul Galvez about his new book, Courbet's Landscapes, The Origins of Modern Painting, which is actually coming out today from Yale University Press. We're recording this interview on May 24th, 2022, and I'm happy to be celebrating its release with its author today. I want to thank everyone at Yale University Press for providing me with an advance copy of the book so that I could read it just before its release for this interview. Before we begin, let me tell you a bit about my guest today. Dr. Paul Galvez is a research fellow at the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History at the University of Texas at Dallas, as well as one of the coordinators of the Institute's master's program in art history. His research interests range broadly from realist painting to the Russian avant-garde to contemporary abstraction, and he takes a multifaceted approach, often drawing from philosophy, literary criticism, the history of science, and conservation practice. He contributed to the catalogue raisonné of Paul Gauguin's Tahitian paintings, and he's active as a curator and critic, organizing exhibitions of post-war and contemporary art in both France and the United States. The book he wrote, which we'll be discussing today, is the first monographic study of Gustave Courbet's landscapes, ranging from the grottos of Courbet's native region to the beaches of Normandy. Dr. Galvez follows the artist as he travels and uses a palette knife to transform the romantic landscape into a direct, visceral confrontation with the material world. The Courbet he discovers is not the celebrated history painter of provincial life, but a committed landscapist whose view of nature aligns him with contemporary developments in geology, history, linguistics, and literature. Courbet's Landscapes explores these astonishing paintings, staking a claim for their importance to Courbet's work and to later developments in French modernism. I'm thrilled to be discussing this book with its author on its publication today, on its publication day today, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Paul Galvez, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if you might begin, as we always do, I like to ask this question about background. If you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself, where you are from originally, where you studied art history, maybe any mentors you had along the way. The acknowledgments of this book are a little bit of a who's who in the art history world. They're enticing in and of themselves. So just give us some of your background, if you would.
Sure, Allison. So I'm from Philadelphia, or rather the area around Philadelphia, a town called Villanova, which is probably more known for its basketball team more than anything else. But it does produce the occasional art historian.
Yes.
And, you know, unlike, probably many art historians who speak on this program, I actually did not grow up going to museums, galleries, New York City, even, you know, the Philadelphia Art Museum. My parents came from the Philippines, were first generation immigrants, and art was low on their list of priorities, particularly European painting. So I really discovered art history as a field of endeavor when I went to university, which was at Harvard, where I was an undergraduate. And I had the great kind of fortune to be at a university that not only had a great art history department, but also a great university art museum. The FOG, you know, is one of the best university collections in the country. And it had a particularly vibrant undergraduate student organization affiliated with it. I think it was called the Friends of the Harvard University Art Museum. And so between that and the department, which unlike other departments actually facilitated a lot of face time with undergraduates. You know, you always hear graduate students complaining about, you know, I don't get to see my professor, you know, as often as I would like. But when I was in college, I had tutorials with senior faculty weekly for, you know, 2 hours, which graduate students are incredibly jealous of. And when I went to Columbia later, you know, I would kill to have that much time with my advisor. So it was, you know, it was a really important moment for me. I basically discovered art there, both in terms of intellectual interests, but also the actual physical works, which, you know, over the course of my career has become very important for me. And hopefully will come out in the book when people read it, because it's very much focused on description of paintings.
Yeah, you know, I was struck that the, and I love when books do this, you began with visual analysis. I mean, you began by describing one of these Corbet landscapes that you're going to make a big deal of throughout the rest of the book. And I think that grounding in looking at the art, which is so ever-present throughout this book, I mean, I like to see that. I'm sure there are those who think, you know, oh, there are better ways or different ways to begin books, but that was definitely present for me.
Well, one of the things that informed that really was that ever since I was an undergraduate, I wrote art criticism for the, the newspaper, the campus newspaper. But then later when I graduated for basically any venue I could write for. So I think that one of the first ones is actually film reviews at the back of Time Out Paris, back when it existed.
Oh, wow.
They were completely anonymous, so you can find them now, thank God. But, you know, that I tell my students, you know, that's how you start. And once you build up this portfolio, you kind of move on. And so I've continued to write for Art Forum and various exhibition catalogs after that. But and in those formats, you do have a responsibility to describe the thing you're talking about.
Yes.
As the kind of one of the primary roles of the first critic is to just get into the historical record what it is you're talking about. And so that carried over into my more historical work, for sure.
Yeah, I can see that now. Well, let me ask you the follow-up question, I guess the logical follow-up question, which is how did you come to write this specific book? Like, how did you become interested in Corbet's landscapes, and how did you decide, I got to write this?
Well, you know, at Columbia, at the time when I was there, and I'm going back to your previous question for a little bit here, at the time, you know, for the studies of 20th century art, it was really one of the best programs, at least in my opinion, at the time. Rosalind Krauss was there, Benjamin Buchlow, Jonathan Crary, Barry Bergdahl in architecture. And so for 20th century studies, it was incredibly strong. And that was both the attraction, but then you realize when you have to formulate a topic, the air becomes a little thin. So what happened was that I was doing some, you know, preliminary research in Europe on a topic on conceptual art, on post-war conceptual art. And as one does when one is a grad student, one takes trips to go see works of art. And that particular summer, I went from Hamburg all the way down Germany along the Rhine to Basel, just to, you know, supplement my art historical education. And I was expecting to, you know, see all this Northern Renaissance and Dutch art, which I did see. But in each museum, there were usually 2 to 3 Courbet landscapes and oftentimes 1 or 2 masterpieces. And it became a recurring theme as I went from small German, West German town to small West German town. And at the end of the trip, I'm like, wow, that was a really unknown body of work, you know, not the Courbet that I learned in school. And I was fascinated, so I just did a preliminary literature search. And, you know, there were a handful of things, but mostly chapters and essays, and many of which were written in the 80s. And so I thought, you know, maybe this is worth writing about. Plus, it would solve this problem of how to distinguish myself from my peers and mentors, but nonetheless staying within the field of modern art. It's just an earlier moment.
Yeah.
And what struck me about them was their sensuality and handling. And you know, you always hear that Courbet painted with a palette knife and had incredibly kind of thick textures, but the cliche is that it's so thick that it looks like mortar or some unruly paste. But what struck me about these works was that they gave this sense of incredible relief, but were nonetheless painted not so thickly. In fact, with very slimmed down paint layers in very measured touches. So that became the starting point for what became this book about Courbet's landscapes. But it was originally that initial kind of conundrum, you know, why do these things look so thick when they are in fact not that thickly painted, contrary to what the image of him was already even in the 19th century.
Yeah. I love that when a dissertation begins with a conundrum, you know you've hit on something that, you know, is worth analyzing. And if you do it right, then it really can be, you know, a kind of glorious first book. I'm going to ask you, Paul, to speak up a little bit. My fear is that you're saying such great things, and I want to make sure that the audio, which I just notoriously have problems with on this podcast, is super loud. So project for us a little bit more, and let's hope that it's just me hearing your audio being a little bit more diminished compared to mine. Let me ask you the tough question right up front here. Let's just get it out of the way. I feel like this is a little bit snarky, but it has to be asked. Courbet is one of these figures who have been written about to such a voluminous extent. I mean, I think an art historian could probably spend the rest of their career trying to just read the scholarship on Courbet. There have been so many people in numerous languages, I mean, in French, in German, in English, who've written on Courbet. Why another book on Courbet is, of course, going to be something that people are going to think maybe when they see this book on Yale's list. What did you feel had to be said? I mean, you've already kind of gotten us into this with this conundrum that you started with about maybe something of something we take for granted or think we know about Courbet's landscapes that proves not to be true when you see them in person. But how did you get over this feeling, or did you have this feeling of, oh, am I really going to write another book or add another book on Courbet?
No, that is certainly the big question. And the answer can also be very long.
Yeah.
But certainly if you go to any shelf in a library, it's an entire row of Courbet books, and many of which were written in the last, you know, 3 decades. So it's there's a lot, and that's not even counting what was written before. And you know, coming from a background in 20th century art and in art that is not referential, often, you know, I was attuned to that aspect of Courbet that is not so easily amenable to a iconographic reading of figures, essentially. Many of these landscapes don't have figures, but they are striking for the way they are painted. And in narratives of 19th century art, the liberation of gesture, the kind of undoing of academic norms, is often allied with Impressionism and the painting of contemporary subjects in the open air. And what struck me about these corbeilles is that that is not at all the case. They are not in the open air. They are not about Parisian urban life. Yet they are nonetheless very inventive in terms of the pictorial mark, which would become very important for modernism, you know, through Impressionism to Cézanne and onto Cubism. So I felt that that Ariadne's thread through modern art was one that had not been addressed by the Courbet scholarship, or if it had, it was in bits and pieces and never as a overarching narrative that could be connected all the way to the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So that was going to be my lead-in. And I never, you know, pretended from the beginning that I was going to overthrow decades of scholarship, but I did think that there was a story to be told, and that it was not just limited to the story of a particular technique or particular genre, but a way of art making that had important effects on the history of art.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad I asked you about it just so that we could kind of like get that justification out of the way, and it gets us a little bit into what you do in this book. And I should mention that the book has kind of a classic structure. It has an introduction at the beginning and a coda at the end. And then in between are what I felt were four really manageable chapters. I have to compliment you, Paul. I never felt like, oh, this chapter is never going to end. You didn't, you know, sometimes you read books that have this 3 or 4 chapter structure and they're so long that it's very difficult to get through them. But these, I don't know, your writing really moved. And I should say too, this book is so beautifully designed. I mean, it just like from the moment I got it, the cover, the interior, Yale just did a job with this that is kind of astounding. It's so modern. It's very chic. I mean, it feels very of our moment how they designed this. So the four chapters that are within it, I'll just say the names of them and then we begin kind of getting into them. You have chapter one is Bags of Paint in Glassy Skins. Chapter two is When Landscape Became Language. Chapter three, Milk of the Sea. And chapter four is Cut with a Palette Knife, which of course reminds me a little bit of Hannah Hoche's cut with a kitchen knife. Yep, Paul is shaking his head as though I've hit onto something. They're all really slick chapter titles that are very enticing too. I'm trying to think what I want to ask you. Maybe it's a follow-up question to what I already said, because in the introduction, you nod, as you, I think you have to the scholarship that's been done, as you said, kind of scattered in various places. But so many luminaries within our field have talked about Courbet's landscapes, though not at the kind of sustained book length level that you have. But what that forces you to do from the very beginning that had to have been kind of scary, so tell me if it was or if it wasn't, is engage with some real luminaries in our field. You have to talk about T.J. Clark's interpretation of these. You talked a little bit about Clement Greenberg and how he's affecting discourse on Courbet. Michael Fried, of course, looms very large. And then maybe a little bit more peripherally, but they come in later in the book, Petra Chu and Linda Nochlin. I mean, These are some of the most heavyweight hitters in our field. Was it intimidating to kind of grapple and I would say make clear who you kind of agree with and who you don't? I mean, from the intro, it's already clear you don't buy this anthropomorphic reading that is so common, especially among feminist scholars, where the interpretation goes that the paintings, especially of certain grottos, are veiled representations, maybe not so veiled representations of female sex organs. You make it clear you don't buy these interpretations. So how did this kind of grappling with the work of really, you know, important scholars, how did that drive this?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a difficult job to, you know, in any work, let alone something on Courbet, to get through the dreaded literature review. Yeah. And I call it dreaded because I very much, when I wrote this, did not want it to sound like a dissertation turned book or, you know, the introduction to a dissertation where you are required to do that type of parsing of the scholarship.
I'll just jump in and say, I don't think it does. I read a lot of books where that is a factor and I'm a little bit disappointed, but it's almost like you're too spicy for it to have been a dissertation. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't make the moves that you make if this was just a dissertation lit review.
And to just return to your comment on the titles, I weighed the risk of having titles that do not indicate at all what the topic of the chapter is going to be. I could just as easily say chapter 2, grottos, chapter 3, mm-hmm. seascapes, chapter 4, Corbeil Impressionism. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to signal it so directly. I wanted there to be a little bit of kind of intrigue and mystery. So that's why I used those evocative titles. Mm-hmm. And then to break things up, as you notice, there are subtitles within the text that I also tried to make, for good reading. So I was very conscious of trying to not have the usual scholarly tone when writing about these landscapes, which is also, I think, why Yale decided to go with the design that they did, which I can talk about maybe a little bit later, because that's another mm-hmm. story in of itself. So my strategy was, instead of going, Professor X said this, Professor Y says this, I decided, well, I can't talk about every single person, but I can talk about five main points or avenues of approach to these works. And some of them are aligned strongly with an individual or group of individuals, and some of them are more dispersed through the literature, like the anthropomorphic reading. And so I just organized them as such and tried to cover the range and, paying respect to all the great authors who have written about this. And I say in the introduction, look, this entire book could have been about the reception of Corbeil and Corbeil studies. And I can't do that. And I can just barely cover what has been said about the landscapes, but I'll try to boil it down to five basic readings. And so they were, let's say the social art historical reading, which has two variants, the symbolic reading of them, the kind of high modernist reading of them, and the anthropomorphic reading. Mm-hmm. And that's how I decided to lay it out. And I once I did lay that out, I also signaled to the reader that, okay, I'm not really going to go back to this throughout the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. I'm laying it out now so that we can get to what I want to say.
Yeah.
And what is my contribution, hopefully, to this field. And so I don't really return to those arguments except obliquely throughout the text, which I also think helps it flow, in my opinion.
I think it's very effective. It's sort of like you had to do it, you did it, and then you moved on and very quickly got into what you wanted to say. So maybe this is the moment where I should ask you, as difficult as it is, I always feel like this is another unfair question. I wouldn't want to be asked this about my book, but what do you argue for, Paul, in this book? What is the contribution that you want to make, the takeaway, the kind of nutshell soundbite that you see as important about Corbeil's landscapes and their relationship to modern painting?
Well, I think one of the kind of traditional readings of landscape in the 19th century is that in some ways, especially pre-impressionist landscape, is that it's an escape from history, that mm-hmm. it is a withdrawal from society. And those of us who've been in the countryside during the pandemic know all about that, because it is a form of escapism in a sense. But what I wanted to show was that it's a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. That landscape is of that moment where there was a growing historical consciousness, but it is not reflected in a kind of approach to painting that is based on history painting and narrative and the kind of dominance of the human figure in certain situations. And one of the ways I did that was by linking it to certain discourses in the natural sciences and literature that are contemporaneous with the landscapes, that are trying to kind of delve past the superficial image that nature gives to kind of peel back the layers of its formation And that is something that linguists were doing with language and that geologists were doing with the history of the Earth. You know, taking the, let's say, the 18th century conceptions of those fields and discovering that if you go into the roots of words or the strata of a landscape in geology, that there is another story to be told that is the one that has either been hidden, repressed, or is the unofficial story. And one of the second chapter about when landscape became language is very much about Courbet's rather intense dialogue with individuals of those fields at a very personal level, just at the moment that he's painting these incredible grotto paintings that, if one looks at the book or online, look really primordial and kind of encroaching in a way that landscape was not depicted before Courbet. And then the other kind of issue I was interested in was basic, kind of almost a kind of theoretical one about how does an artist go about turning matter into an image? And what are the stages by which one does that? Because it was very, very regimented and controlled through the academy system, but also just for centuries of tradition, how you made an image. And Courbet really is a rupture in that, or let's say, yeah, a kind of point of crisis in that tradition. And, you know, he really kind of went back to, you know, how do I take this sticky stuff, oily stuff, paint and make an image out of it while keeping nonetheless some of the physical properties there in the image. And I think he plays in very interesting ways, particularly in his representations of water and waves and sand, with the capacity of paint to both depict nature but also share the same physical qualities, which is why they have such a magnetic attraction for the viewer, this sensuality and organicism of the surface. It's more than just there's a lot of paint on there.
Yeah.
It's how the matter or the substance relates to the formal image. And kind of in the broader picture of art history, I think that in a way connects with certain things in medieval art where materials are treated differently, and certainly looking forward to the emphasis on making in 20th century art. So I think it's not just an intervention to Courbet studies or even 19th century studies, but in this kind of broader historical discussion of how artists make images.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm glad you described it that way. And I'm glad that you brought up chapter two, when landscape became language. And maybe I'll kind of stick with that. We're jumping ahead and we'll revert back a little bit because I do have questions about those earlier chapters. But it's in this one that you really establish these three basic types of strokes, you call them, that Courbet makes or uses to construct these landscapes. And they're the dab, the scrape or smear, and the deposit. And as I was reading this, I mean, not only do I just kind of love that, it's especially because it's a chapter I feel like I could assign to students and they would get a lot out of it, especially if they are painters themselves or artists, because they want to understand how others build images. They're at that point where they're very interested in that. But then, you know, just regular viewers, I think, standing in front of these paintings are also interested in that. It made me think so much of Robert Herbert's work on Monet, a very famous article we all have to read in graduate school. And I immediately went to your bibliography because I was like, oh, it's going to be there. And it was there. And I thought, oh, I wonder how that piece contributed to maybe the methods or the ideas that you put forward, this kind of breaking down of the, as you said, the way that these paintings are constructed somewhat deceptively in terms of what we think we're seeing versus, you know, how they actually look in person. This leads me maybe also to ask a related question about the reproductions in the book. And that Herbert article is partly famous because it has these extreme details. And that's not something you do a lot in this book. There are a few detail shots strategically placed where you talk about specific things, but there weren't a whole lot. And I wondered if that was something of a choice where you know, when you're talking about a specific kind of mark, say where the dab appears in one of these grotto paintings, did you grapple at all with, ooh, should I include a detail here, or should I kind of describe this in that critical voice that you do, such that the viewer will refer back to the painting and find it themselves?
Well, Allison, you're pointing to one of the notorious difficulties of writing on Courbet and illustrating it, in that the effect that he produces in his paintings is so related to your personal kind of visual experience in front of the work that it is very difficult for a camera to capture it, even with digital technologies. Mm-hmm. And I almost thought about putting a little warning at the very beginning saying, you know, you're going to see that reproductions sometimes do not convey the texture, or there's too much shine because of the lighting, but you need the lighting to see the strokes in the first place. But I think the press did a good job of using the latest kind of image reproductive technologies to at least make that more visible. So one of the things about this book and a lot of more recent books is that the ink is printed on the paper so that it rests on top of the paper rather than being kind of saturated into the weave. And so that allows for a greater range of tones, and allows, at least I think, for the gestures to be more visible. So that, along with the designer's decision to make these large two-page spreads and you know, all the way to the edge of the book, kind of ameliorated made it not so necessary to have so many details. And the thing about the detail is, although they help illustrate the argument, when one sees these works, and one of the things I like about them is that when you see them afar, you notice there's something special about them, and you keep moving closer, waiting to see when the moment that the paint becomes just paint and not a representation of a landscape. But what's interesting about them is that as you get closer, you just see more and more forms in the landscape that happen to be paint-like, rather than the illusion just collapses at a certain moment, which it does for almost all other paintings of the period. And that effect also cannot be captured. I mean, I compare it to going from a telescopic view to a microscopic one in a steady zoom, rather than there being a jump cut from a far view to a near view. So in a way, you know, I decided, well, this is something you really have to see for yourselves, but I'll give you the template or the attack plan to go look at it. So dividing the marks into these three divisions was partially for the viewer or the reader to be armed with that. But also it was just my own way of trying to describe his unique way of painting, because if it is not super thick and heavy and indiscriminately laid on the canvas, then what is it? And you realize when you look at them that it's incredible subtle how he uses the palette knife. And even that it's sometimes not the palette knife, but a brush mark meant to look like a palette knife mark. Mm-hmm. And that it's not thick, but that is actually slimmed down to create what I call a kind of epidermal patch, which takes those different forms of the scrape, the dab, and the deposit. Mm-hmm. Now, you were very perceptive that, you know, Robert Herbert was at the background, because he's not only there in this chapter, but his writings on Rousseau are also important for me in the chapter where I talk about Théodore Rousseau. Mm-hmm. And Herbert is known mostly for his History of Impressionism book, but many of the things he wrote earlier in his career, Ancerat, Millet, Rousseau, and Monet, have this attentiveness to detail that I find quite remarkable. And certainly one of the inspirations in the Monet article, I believe it's called Method and Meaning in Monet, was that he took, you know, the commonplace that Monet applied color with these layers of gestures and showed that actually he created this texture of kind of neutral or white strokes and then painted the color on top of it that sometimes didn't match the direction of the brushstrokes. Mm-hmm. And that idea of taking what seems to be obvious and showing, in fact, it's an illusion, is in many ways what I saw in Courbet.
Yeah.
That, yes, supposedly he painted in thick palette knife strokes that have a lot of relief, but no. When you look closer, it's, you know, something different altogether. It's thin in a couple layers, but nonetheless, layers that you can identify. So it's neither super flat nor super thick, but in this interesting gray zone in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I was sort of prescient maybe in snipping that out, or I've read the scholarship I need to be able to kind of draw these things out as I'm reading, you know, great new books like yours. I want to ask you about comparisons in this book, because I was struck really from the very beginning, from chapter one. You make these comparisons between the paintings that Courbet and Corot were working side by side and making in 1862. And then you compare a couple of works they produced. Also, later in that chapter, you talk about Théodore Rousseau and how we can kind of compare what he's doing versus what Courbet is doing. You know, between the really descriptive, really juicy moments, let's say, of formal or visual analysis and comparisons, you know, that in many ways drove the book. And I always talk to students about, you know, these are the two things you have to get good at. You have to get good at describing really carefully as a means of making your argument, and you have to get really savvy about what you compare to what as, again, a means of making your argument. So how self-conscious were you about this technique, or do you have advice, let's say, for students or listeners more generally about how forceful comparisons, how effective comparisons can be in the way that they were in this book?
Well, just in general, I think comparisons are the one of the fundamental building blocks of the discipline of art history.
Me too.
You know, one of the things about art history is that it's a form of human endeavor that is not language, is not music, is not documents, it's not text. And it has its own history, which allows us to do these comparisons of world art and not sound like we're crazy. and from a methodological perspective, I think that if you make an argument about a work of art and you can't say why it applies to this work and not another, then that really weakens your interpretation because it's not specific at all. If you can say this about, you know, if you can say one work is about, you know, a certain representation of nature and this other one is too, yet they're totally different, then how do you square that? And that actually is historically what happened with Courbet. There were certain realist critics who say, you know, there's no difference between a Courbet and a Corot. I mean, Champfleury, the kind of realist critic that one most associates with the Courbet's early work, said exactly that. Mm-hmm. And many art historians, in fact, took his line of argument. But what was great for me, and in this sense, I was lucky in a way, is that that exact example, Corot and Courbet, could be analyzed historically because they painted side by side. Mm-hmm. And that we actually have two pairs of paintings by them that were painted side by side, which are two of the rare examples of side by side paintings before the mid 1860s, before Impressionism. We just don't have many paintings by two artists painted at exactly the same time of the same site. So it was the perfect moment for what you could call formal analysis, although I don't like to use the term because sometimes it separates it from our historical analysis, and I think they're all interwoven. Mm-hmm. So let's just say for deep comparison. and then I always imagined from the very beginning that one of the goals I had for this book was to distinguish Courbet from romantic landscape painting, as it was understood at the time. And Corot and Rousseau were two representatives of the main schools, if you want to call them that, at the time, you know, historical landscape painting and romantic Barbizon school of painting. Since it was very important to make that distinction, I knew I had to weave them into the ideally the first chapter. I was also lucky in that there was a work in the Louvre that I just stumbled upon by sheer accident, and it happened to be on the wall at the time, of this Rousseau kind of drawing on canvas mm-hmm. of the source of the Lison River. Now, that has never, as far as I know, been reproduced in the Courbet literature before. And that's because no one really knew that Rousseau painted that site, because that work is hardly ever shown. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I saw it, I thought, well, I think the Courbet painted that, but it looks nothing like the Courbet, as I explained in the book. It's drawn, yeah. The point of view is different. The whole feel of the landscape is different. And so that allowed me to compare them very directly. Mm-hmm. And so it just worked out that I not only compared Courbet to Corot and Rousseau, but that I had actual examples of them painting the same thing. So yeah. If you can, I mean, to tell your students, if you find that and it hasn't been talked about before, that's already something important that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the Holy Grail. Yeah.
And I would say that particularly in the studies of 19th century art, which, sometimes resembles, art historical studies of the Renaissance, of an altarpiece, where you take this one work and go through its iconography, the Dejeuner sur l'Heure by Manet. And that takes, because it's such a complicated work, it takes a long time to go through that you sometimes forget to compare it to other paintings of the same subject around the same time, it's through the opposition and through the difference that the originality of that work comes out, really. Mm-hmm. And so that was another reason why I wanted a lot of comparisons in there. Mm-hmm. Because these landscapes are not meant to be these grand statement salon paintings. They're done in series, and they're meant to be in dialogue with other landscapes, both in the same series and in series by other artists. So basically a different kind of painting requires a different kind of mode of interpretation.
Yeah.
And I felt, going back to your initial question about why it was important to do this book, I wanted to provide just another way of thinking about painting at that time that requires a different mode of historical inquiry, and that requires a different mode of description. Mm-hmm. And that's why both comparisons and close looking at works of art are very important to the book.
Yeah. And it gets us maybe away from some of the interpretations of these that had come to dominate, and I'm not denigrating these in any way because I think they make a lot of sense. But so often these landscapes are talked about as what Courbet just wanted to sell. And these were selling. He was doing well in Belgium. He's doing well in Germany. He's traveling there, which is why you're able to find so many of these, as you said before, in those places today. And it sort of nods to that as, okay, that's one explanation, but you basically say, I don't think that's the whole story here. I want to ask you about another maybe stylistic or interpretive thing that I saw you doing, again, from the very beginning, from the introduction, but then scattered throughout the book. I'm trying to think how to describe it. It's about intention, I guess. It's about establishing the intention of the artist or why you think he did something that you see him doing in these paintings. You say at one point in the intro, quote, he, as in Courbet, wanted us to feel as if we were experiencing the world at an earlier stage of its creation. In chapter 2, you talk about Courbet painted ancient grottos and shrouded riverbeds because they were uninhabited, primeval, and felt almost unescapable. In chapter 3, you say Courbet didn't depict aspects of modern leisure at seaside resorts, quote, because of his overriding commitment to the representation of matter. And I'm putting these little breadcrumbs out because I want both listeners to get a little bit of a sense of the kinds of interpretations that are in this book, but also your voice. But I have to admit, Paul, I was like, oh, danger, danger, Paul. Like, whenever I see an art historian saying he wanted us to feel something or he did this because here's the reason, and then that's it. I always worry, you know, intention is maybe the trickiest thing that we deal with. It's the thing we should be talking about, we have to talk about, but it's also so hard to establish from a historical standpoint. How much did you feel this danger as you were writing these lines? You know, did any of these ping you, the ones that I read, in terms of like, oh yeah, I really kind of grappled with how to say that because I know it's dangerous? Or did you just feel really confident and you're like, yeah, this is what Corbe wanted us to feel, I'm just going to say it?
Well, I have two ways of answering that.
Okay.
First of all, obviously we can't know the artist's intention because we can't read their minds and we weren't there at the time. And even if we did ask the artist, what were you doing in that painting? You can't necessarily say what they said is the truth. Right.
So true. Yes. Artists lie, everyone. We're telling you right now.
Yeah, they have
or sometimes
memory.
They don't know. They don't know why they're doing what they're doing. Yeah.
Or they can't express it, or they remember badly. But my way of thinking about that is that essentially when we come up with our ideas about how an artist works or what they're trying to do, it's a fiction we create for ourselves about what we think they're doing. So I presume from the very beginning we can't know, but I'm constructing my fiction in almost monographic biographical form of the thought process that might have happened along the way, even though it's really mine. It just happens to correlate, at least I hope it does, with what evidence remains.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative is that, I'm not sure what you have in mind here exactly, but let's say we were just to show all the statements and documents that pertain to this work. Well, that has to be put in some sort of order anyway. And I just think that for the reader and for our still kind of post-romantic way of thinking about artistic subjectivity, this kind of pseudo-intention or like imagined intention is still one that I'm quite comfortable with. And perhaps that has to do with the fact that I originally wrote on 20th century art, and that way of writing is not necessarily taboo there, especially on contemporary art. I mean, it's often the case, you know, X artist was trying to do this. Now there you can sometimes point to what the artist said, but I actually think it's more interesting when they don't say it or where you disagree with what they say.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, what I'm saying is that my text, like any discourse, is a kind of open text, and it's kind of not about the author, but about the reader and how they take what is given to them.
Interesting. Well, I will say this about it, you know, listeners, whether you agree or disagree with this interpretive model, I prefer personally for an author to come out and make the kind of argument that you do and say, look, this is what I think he was feeling. This is why I think he did specifically what he did here in this painting. Then, you know, you read some of these more sort of passive ways of doing it or more careful ways of doing it. And in the end, you're like, what were they arguing for? Like, I can't even figure out what the claim is here. And I don't think, I never had that impression in your book. Every chapter, I knew what the takeaway was. It was very clear what you were, whether I necessarily agreed with it by the end or not. And I think in most cases, I was quite convinced, even if I still had lingering questions like this interview is proving. I want to move to chapter 3, Milk of the Sea, which has so much packed into it. I mean, I don't think there's any way I could ever summarize it, but it's about the seascapes, as you kind of mentioned and hinted at before. And you do a lot of work to help us understand in this chapter where the seascapes fit with what you've already been establishing are the kind of driving forces and mechanisms behind the landscapes more generally. You talk about the general equivalence of the pictorial field here, what you call Courbet's touch-by-touch technique, all sorts of interesting things about these seascapes, the abolishment of figuration and narrative. I mean, I could go on and on, the viewpoints, all sorts of stuff. But I was excited about this chapter, maybe because of the work that I'm doing currently, because you finally address some of Courbet's nude women in landscapes and seascapes here, which may be what many readers coming to this book know more about. You know, when they think about his landscapes, they may not have necessarily seen the kind of pure land and seascapes that you describe, but they'll know these infamous naked women, you know, bathing in these spaces. And you talk specifically, I should say, about The Spring and about The Woman in the Waves, which are both from 1868. Talk about another kind of interesting, you know, both in the same year, comparable, but very different, you know. You talk about Courbet's, I'm trying to think, I have several questions about this chapter. I want to ask the most important or salient one. Let me go to the end where you talk about The Woman in the Waves, which will be a painting many, especially New York listeners, know because it's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And it seems to be always up. I don't feel like I've ever visited and it was down. It's right there next to his 1866 Woman with a Parrot. And you talk about the froth from the waves around this particular nude as, quote, metaphorically constituting a kind of milk of the sea. And there's a comparison going on here that is bigger than we can get into with the historian Jules Michelet. And then you talk about there being a kind of association with maternal nourishment going on here in terms of how he's painted this froth and how weird the froth is, how weird it is compared to the body. I have just always thought, Paul, there is just nothing maternal about Courbet's nude women. It almost is weird how, especially comparing to artists maybe like Renoir, where the maternal is so constantly ever present. So I'm wondering how you arrived at this conclusion. I'm also thinking that froth is so often compared not to milk, but to male ejaculate, which, you know, is kind of grotesque, but gets us back to this anthropomorphic, anti-feminist sentiment that seems to undergird so much of Courbet's work, aside from the landscapes. So maybe this was the moment where I was most stuck, where I was like, what? Milk? No, it doesn't even look like milk. Was this something that you grappled with a lot before you arrived at it, or maybe in peer review that there was some back and forth, or you stand by this claim and we should just move on?
It actually did not come up in peer review. The question of the feminist scholarship on Courbet, that certainly is relevant and did come up in a general sense. Mm-hmm. With Courbet, especially in the 1860s, although it's true for his earlier work as well, the female nude figure as the figure of desire, of the symbol of eroticism, is unavoidable, as it is for many artists of the period. It's in the air. I mean, you just cannot ignore it. There are entire salons filled with naked Venuses and all kinds of goddesses that really look like contemporary models. And that's, of course, one of the great kind of aperçus of Manet's Olympia, that you know, you have this conflation of the two. Courbet certainly was reacting to Manet, and in fact, there was a tit for tat between them. You know, who can do the contemporary nude slash goddess in the most modern way? Mm-hmm. But the Women in the Waves is a particular case. And I guess I'll start by saying that the association of woman with nature, you know, is kind of as old as human history. And so when I say maternal, maybe I don't necessarily mean it as mother and child, but the female figure as a personification of the generative or the fertility, the kind of production, biological kind of production side of femininity, which Courbet is tapping into. So this is not a mother with child, but it is a figure that is rather robust, healthy, curvaceous, and clearly associated with the kind of abundant side of nature, waves and froth. Someone did ask me about the milk. And indeed, I was reading it through a chapter of Michelet's work on the sea called The Sea of Milk. And since I'm making in that book a strong correlation between the metaphor of substance in Michelet and the metaphor of substance in Courbet, that's where I went. Although if it was semen, that's still a bodily substance and it's still kind of associated with production. So it's not too crazy. But the way that the froth is around the breasts, these incredibly kind of eroticized breasts, that I think that was the association that would have most come to mind. But I think it's important to say that the woman in the waves is the kind of figuration of substance that is not the primary mode of the seascapes that I like to talk about that have no figures. It shows what Courbet could have done but did not. And I say, I believe at the very end, it's for the best that he didn't do that, because it makes it all too easy to have our experience of the material world filtered by another person. Whereas what really happens in the figureless seascapes is a corporeality or materiality without a particular body. It's just a field of substance, like being, I call it, in a non-claustrophobic womb. And so my response to a lot of the literature about the eroticism and the feminization of nature is that Courbet is actually interested in a kind of sensuality that is not focused through a particular gender or gendered body. It's just the body as substance, which is ungendered. So that's how I was framing the sensuality of the seascapes.
I want to. I see that we're running out of time, but I have one more question that really is it's going to bother me if I don't ask it, because by the end of this book, it was really the only thing that I was like, oh, I want this. I want this still. So in chapter four, the cut with a palette knife, which precedes the coda, which we won't have time to talk about. Listeners will just have to get the book and read it and enjoy and, you know, email Paul their questions and things, or talk to him after he gives lectures. I think there's one upcoming at the Barnes that people can catch. So this is such a cool chapter because you really depart from Courbet in some ways to think about how he inspired other artists. And this, I think, will be something a lot of readers are very interested in. You talk about, or you compare, again, really kind of strategically and very productively with Manet, with Renoir, with Degas, with Pizarro, and with Cézanne. And the Cézanne, oh man, I mean, this book made me not only really excited to look at Courbet's landscapes in person again, but to see some Cézannes in person again. And I am going to go see that show in Chicago. So you've made me very eager for getting like up close and personal with these things. But what I want to ask you about that I found so intriguing in this last full chapter was the bit of psychoanalyzing of Cézanne that you do here, where you talk about this love-hate relationship he had with his father, and so many have with their fathers, let's say more generally, as driving the pictorial conflict in his work. And I immediately wrote in the margin, I want you to do this with Courbet. Why, in the same sense, was it so important to Courbet to, as you say, generate the sensation of being immersed in matter? Why did he, is there a similar explanation, create the illusion of this kind of eternally pleasurable world of substance? Is there an answer?
Well, I almost want to go back to what you said about artistic intention, because my bugaboo is psychobiography. And I'm obviously playing with it here. But I think there's historical reasons for that. The circle of Cézanne at that time included Zola, of course. And they were both really, really fascinated by the artistic temperament or personality. So the psychology of the artist was actually one of their main theoretical preoccupations. And so the idea that the artistic subject is subject to drives and instincts and shaped by the material world, and that often these desires and drives are in conflict with each other, comes out not so much in Zola's art criticism, but in his novels. And if you look at their correspondence, they're very interested in violence and almost the eroticism of death. Mm-hmm. So for them, and for Cézanne, to take an approach that deals with the psychology of the artist and its parallel in painting is not a stretch, I would argue. And many historians of literature have argued about Zola at just this moment that Cézanne is painting these portraits of his father and his uncle as almost proto-psychoanalytic in nature. So what I would say is that I'm not doing a psychoanalytic reading or certainly not a psychobiographical reading, but I'm drawing on those concepts to try to explain why Cézanne's use of the palette knife is so different from Courbet. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that the cliche that we have of Courbet as a Mason painter or a kind of painter de classe really applies to Cézanne at this moment and not to Courbet. The reason why I couldn't do the same for Courbet's eternally pleasurable world is that I don't think that the discourse around his landscapes or his own thinking about it delved into the psyche as much. I mean, I very much frame it as an approach to how to represent matter in painting and to have substance as much as you can, real substance, in an illusory world that historically in the history of art, in the history of European painting, does not want too much substance on the canvas. In order for its truth value to hold. So it's really a question of the different context of the two artists. And you know, there's certain artists like Van Gogh and Cézanne that lend themselves to that, and probably too much in the literature. Yeah. But and there's certain artists that it's less effective with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm satisfied with that answer. As much as I may have, you know, wanted that, I understand why you didn't go there in Courbet's case the way that you sort of did at the end of the book with Cézanne. Oh, Paul, thank you so much for this. I want to ask you the traditional quick last question here on New Books Network, which is just to tell us briefly what you're working on now. What can we look forward to coming out from you hopefully soon?
So having worked on landscape painting in the 1860s for a good chunk of time, my new project is about sculpture in the 1880s, particularly the ceramic sculptures of Paul Gauguin, which like Courbet's landscapes, are a body of work that is much less studied in Gauguin studies as the landscapes are in Courbet's studies. And Gauguin, you know, is known for, you know, being very inventive in color, but he was also really important in the history of modern art for bringing back myth, and particularly world myth, as something that's okay to have in painting. Moreover, that interest in religiosity and the mythical was carried over into non-traditional media, like wood carving and ceramic sculpture. Mm-hmm. So the whole project is called The Other Gauguin because it is the Gauguin that we don't know, but it also is about the idea that Gauguin thought of himself as an other. And that, of course, is a very controversial topic, which maybe we can save for another podcast.
Have to interview you about that book for sure. Yeah, this sense that of his, you know, calling himself a savage and a child and embracing the wild beast side of himself. Mm-hmm.
And it's really about how you have hybridity in art at all levels, you know, formal, material, but also conceptual and subjective hybridity.
Yeah, The Other Gauguin. All right, everybody, keep an eye out for it. Paul likes the bad boys of art history for sure, between Courbet and Gauguin. I think about these ceramics of, I don't know, like weird disembodied hands groping the inside of women's skulls. And I think, oh my Lord. So I will definitely be contacting you when that book comes out to talk about it as well. All right, everybody, you have been listening to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Allison Lee, and I've been talking to Paul Galvez about his new book, Courbet's Landscapes, The Origins of Modern Painting. As always, if you have questions or comments about this episode, you can contact me through my website at allison-lee.com or find me on Instagram at Professor Lee. Thanks so much for listening.